Looking for media and
its reflection.
Join us for general orientation every third Thursday, 12, 3, and 6 p.m.
3647 University, CKUT
90.3
FM.
Oh, they're very shrewd. I must say, they're really quite remarkable in their ability to use the media.
And welcome to Ecolibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is your host, Ryan Young. We have a great show for you today, so we're going to get right into it. I don't know if you're interested in organic vegetables and fruits, but there is a great farmer's market in St. Anne de Bellevue every Saturday. It just had its first outdoor market this past Saturday, and it will be continuing until, I think, mid-October, there's a farm that sells its produce there called Ferme de Lille, and I spoke to Constantinos Hertel Catou, who is the owner of Ferme de Lille, a farm that up until recently has been operating in Senneville, but is now moving to just off the island in Les Cèdes. And it was great to talk to Konstantinos. So here is that interview now. This is Ryan Young for CKUT 90.3 FM, and I'm here at the St. Anne de Bellevue Farmers Market. It's the first day that they're having it outdoors, and I'm here with a farmer who sells his produce at the market, Konstantinos Hertel-Catou, and he is the owner of Ferme de Lille Montreal, which is a farm that up until now has been farming in Senneville, but is transitioning to another location in Les Cèdes. And how are you doing today?
I'm doing really good. Yeah, I'm happy to be at the first outdoor market. It's a big day. And it really feels like the season is kicking off.
And you grew up in NDG, right?
I grew up in Montreal West. Yeah, which is right next to NDG. Yeah.
And then you were a student for a while at McDonald campus.
Yeah, I was at McDonald campus for about a year and a half. Yeah.
In the farm management technology program.
Exactly. The program is quite the opposite from organic farming. It's more conventional farming, and they take in a lot of students that are coming from agricultural communities, multi-generational farms, really large scale. So it was still like a very worthwhile experience. And at the time, like, I was actually in my mind, I was like asking myself, like, oh, is this what I'm gonna do? Like, even though my first experience had been organic and I loved it, I then after like a couple semesters was asking myself, like, am I gonna be a conventional animal producer? Am I gonna be a cash crop producer? Like, how do I even do that? You know, like, I don't have that kind of capital or can't make those kinds of investments. And I kind of hit a wall after the second semester, and I started watching a lot of documentaries about farming, about conventional ag, about food systems. And I sort of made up my mind at that point that conventional farming wasn't what I wanted to do. I decided that I wanted to pursue organic agriculture, sustainable agriculture, permaculture, biodynamic farming. Those were all the types of agriculture that really interested me. And then, after that, I traveled. I actually stopped going to school. I left the program after a year, and I traveled for 6 months. And then I went back to the program again. I gave it another chance. I did the second year, third semester. And then after that semester again, I was fed up, and I just realized that, like, I didn't need school to make my dreams become a reality. So I just, after that, I didn't start the farm right away. Actually, what I did was I started a sustainable landscaping / urban ag company that would do landscaping, but with bikes and trailers. So like a zero emissions, all electric powered landscaping company. And at the same time, I would scout out plots of land in the city where we could do urban ag. And we got about what I would say was like, we found ourselves with about a quarter acre to a half acre of land. And that's like where I first started actually like producing something on, even though it was a very small scale, it was enough to actually start selling it. And then after 2 years of that,
And you would sell that at markets, I guess?
Yeah, we would sell that at markets, and it was very sketchy. Sketchy's not the best word, but it was like very thrown together, very ragtag, just like show up at a park and just set up.
Why not?
Yeah. And we weren't making any money or anything. It was just for fun. And then the following year, I acquired a bit of land from the same farmer who I had done my first ever farming experience with. And that same year, he actually went out of business, and then I took over. And then now we're 5 years later.
So that was Ferme de Lille.
That was Ferme de Lille. Wow. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And with Ferme de Lille,
had you known about the farming going on in Centerville? How did you end up like discovering that there was a little kind of cluster of farms out there in Centerville?
Yeah, so after the first year that I volunteered for Stephen Homer at Ferme du Zephyr, I mean, immediately I became immersed in the community. So there was Samuel Oslin and Howard Reitman, who founded the Centre Paul Roulant, which I then, when I started Ferme de Lille on the same land, we actually shared, we shared the farm for up until now. I worked side by side with the Roulant. And then also there's Les Jardins Carrea, Ramsey and Alex Flores, who were always like huge mentors to me. They actually like even rented us land at the beginning and just like taught me so much. And then every year it's like there's new people. In the last couple of years, I've become more and more connected with Tournesol. There's just so many different agricultural projects going on. Recently, I've been working with Des Trois Pierres. I've been working with Ferme Souffle de Vie, which is a vineyard. And even going further than the local community, going a little bit further to the farms in Rigaud, there's the Verger du Son. So I wasn't so exposed to the Marché Sainte-Anne at the beginning. I was marketing most of my stuff in NDG because that's where I'm from. And then it was only 2 years ago that I started at the Marché Sainte-Anne, and that's when I really felt like I had found my niche in the community and all these other farmers who are just like in the same area. And now it's just, I've just been like, you know, networking with them and just growing those relationships and learning and yeah, it's amazing.
It is a kind of a neat scene that's going on you know, maybe answer the question, what is it you like about farming in general, and what do you like about farming in your current milieu, even though you are moving out to farm in Les Cèdres as well, and mm-hmm. and the market, of course, you're mm-hmm. going to continue selling here at the market. Yeah.
Well, first of all, like I like being my own boss. I like being in control. I don't like so much having somebody tell me what to do. That being said, like I mean, I don't know. I signed up for a lot of work. I mean, it's definitely not that I'm lazy, because I work myself down to the bone, you know, but I love being in nature. I love being outside. I love being active. I love growing things, and I have a very creative side, that's probably the creative side is probably encompasses all of those things, because it's like a canvas. The farm for me is like a canvas, you know, it's like a living canvas, and what you create, it comes to life, and everything interacts, and it's like, it's just a never-ending playground of, you know, and you can be so creative, and you can build your farm into whatever you want it to be, and you can always change it, and you can always learn new things, and you can always meet new people, and you can always share, and at the same time, like, you're feeding people, you know? And also the lifestyle, you know, I just love the lifestyle. And for all those reasons, you know, that's why I love farming.
What did you like about farming in Centerville and the Marché Sainte-Anne? And maybe you can compare it even to your experience in the city.
Yeah, for sure. The way that I've strategized my business is to go slowly and to build up assets, build up clientele, and that goes back to when I started the landscaping company, because it's like, it was a way to start small with little investment needed and then slowly grow and grow and grow. And moving to Centerville was like, it was a rented place with already set up infrastructure, like a really good deal. And it allowed me again to just grow slowly without needing to go to the bank and take out a huge loan or go and make an investment for hundreds of thousands of dollars in land before I really knew what I was doing. And the thing about Centerville is having so many of these farmers right in my backyard allowed me to get a huge educational experience through trial and error, but also through just like picking people's brains and even copying what they were doing, until I found my own niche and until I found my own confidence and my own strengths. And now moving off the island and really feeling like I'm in a real agricultural community, which is like I've never felt so much like in my element before. But it's been like a transition to get there. And definitely like the tight-knit community in Senville, the amount of learning experience, and it's so invaluable. It's just, it makes all the difference between success and failure.
And, you know, you've been involved in this kind of thing for a while. Have you seen a change in people, in society, in terms of being more interested in these kinds of products, organic produce?
Yeah, for sure. I think that the overall demand is growing. The reason I say that is because also I see so many new farms popping up, so many new projects every year, and it's like the demand is not slowing. You know, it's only growing, and the more, like, even though there's more people doing it, there's still an increased demand. So it just goes to show you that people do care about where their food comes from, and especially when they can talk to the person who actually grows their food. It makes them feel, it gives them a sense of security. It makes them feel good about their choices, their purchasing power. And at the same time, they can ask whatever they want about what they're eating and how it was grown, and give them the peace of mind, you know. COVID also has really opened people's eyes up. And I guess maybe because all the restaurants are closed too, people just have to go get them their food themselves, you know. That was like always like one of my strategies with farming, was like I always like to say that like no matter what happens, people need to eat, you know. So it's like I'm in the right business, you know.
What are the primary challenges?
The primary challenges
for
right.
for a farmer like you, you know, not just any old farmer, but a farmer that you know sells mainly their stuff through farmers markets and mm-hmm. works on smaller pieces of land. And
my biggest challenge is probably managing my stress. Honestly, like I can handle all of the practical application stuff. What really gets to me is the stress. And over the years, like I would have never said that in my first year, you know, but now it's like, I want to have a good quality of life too. There's a bit of a stereotype around farming. I mean, it's not, I don't even know if it's a stereotype, but it's just true that farmers work really hard, you know. And it's also, I think it's a pretty underrated conversation topic, like just mental health in general, farm health and safety, you could call it. And like farmers are like some of the most dedicated workers who sacrifice so much for their profession. And it takes a toll on you, you know. It takes a toll on your family. It takes a toll on you. And I think I want to, every year that I go on, that I continue, I'm trying to like break that stereotype. I try and pay my workers more than minimum wage. I don't just try, I do it. I really try with all my will to like not work overtime. And I also have lately been forcing myself to take days off. Like even if I have work to do, I just tell myself like it doesn't matter, you know, like you're gonna be more productive if you rest versus if you push yourself to your limits. And then other aspects of stress, just like stress is just like a completely self-inflicted ailment, you know. And if you can practice different types of self-love, positive affirmations, things like that, to like let yourself know that you're just doing the best that you can, and like no matter how stressed you get about something, it doesn't mean that you're going to be able to just like all of a sudden do the impossible and do everything that you are stressing about, you know. It's more just accepting the fact that you're just doing the best you can, and you know, and that's good enough, you know. So definitely stress management is like yeah, That's one of the biggest challenges, I think. The second biggest challenge that I would also relate to stress management is financial stress, because margins, the profit margins in farming and agriculture, small scale agriculture, are very small, and you don't have so much room for error, and little mistakes can cost big time. So that's always on the back of your mind, you know, and when those things happen, there's really nothing you can do about it. You're in the negative at that point, you know, and you have to keep on going. And that can be really tough when you feel so discouraged. Yeah, those are definitely some of the biggest challenges. Yeah.
And yet so many people are still going into that type of farming, you know.
Yeah.
It shows their commitment.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, and yeah. Passion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Has there been issues with getting seed because of COVID? There was like a kind of maybe people panic buyed a lot of seed last year, or
Definitely. I saw the biggest demand in seed from my suppliers ever this year, and I waited really late to order my seeds this year, because like I was saying, like, I'm not stressing about things, and I was just like, whatever, you know, I got everything I needed, you know, and the things that they didn't have, well, I found something else, you know. And yeah, it took a long time to get some stuff delivered, but I you know, I still got the stuff when I needed it, even though some things were a little bit later than I would have liked, and everything is progressing well still, and it didn't end up being such a big deal. I think also, like I was talking about earlier, finding my niche, finding the confidence to pursue my own sort of vision of how I want to produce and what I want to produce, has led me to growing things that are not exactly what average like producer is growing. So these sorts of things, it plays to my advantage, because a lot of those types of seeds that I was ordering are things that were just like in stock. Nobody's ordering them. Like, not that nobody's ordering them, but they're not being sold out. Again, that's just like plays to my strength, because I'm looking to do things that are less common. I'm looking to do things that are more niche. And so by nature, that means that I could, you know, I had an easier time finding seeds for them. Yeah.
For sure.
But I mean, it's not only seeds. I noticed a difference with all the suppliers, input suppliers, different types of seed producers, like potato seed producers. That was probably what had me the most stressed about seed, because I grow up a lot of potatoes, as you probably know. And I couldn't find potatoes from any of the suppliers that I normally get them from. And I really had to dig around and find a new supplier. And they didn't actually want to sell me them, because when I found a new supplier, they didn't want to sell them to me because I didn't want to order enough. And I really had to grease the wheels to get my potato seed. But anyway, I got it. So it all worked out. Yeah, it all worked out.
Good. That's good. And then looking back on the time you were in the program Farm Management Technology at McDonald mm-hmm. Campus, you and I have kind of talked occasionally about it before. You know, you of course you respect that they're teaching conventional agriculture, and that's what it is. But what were some of the things that you found off-putting or you know, disappointing when you were a student there?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I've never been too attracted to like school in general, so I'll just put that out there. And I also want to say that like I learned a lot from that program too. A lot of it had nothing to do with conventional agriculture. It just has to do with agriculture in general, like botany and welding and small tools and machinery maintenance and all those sorts of things, which are just invaluable lessons, and soil preparation and learning how to use different implements and tractors and stuff like that. And I loved all that, and there was always things that I took out of it that got me to where I am now. But some of the things that I found off-putting, one of the big things that I found off-putting was that I tried to inject my passion for organic agriculture into the things that we were doing in class, and I got shut down pretty hard. And I also, there were times when the teachers themselves would discriminate about organic farming and permaculture in front of me, in front of the other students in the class. And that was really, that was the nail in the coffin for me. Because I was just like, what am I wasting my time with here? Like, these people don't care, you know? But at the same time, like, taking courses in accounting and marketing and all those things, I mean, you don't have to apply those subjects. You don't have to apply them to conventional farming. You can apply them to organic farming. But it was more just like the atmosphere that I was studying in. I just felt like an outsider. I always felt like an outsider in that program from the very moment that I started. I mean, I was with a bunch of, you know, like I said, they were all like, 90% of the students were coming from big farms, generational farms. They were always joking about, you know, what kind of tractors they're using, like if they have a fleet of John Deere's or if they have a fleet of Massey Ferguson's or if they have a fleet of Case, you know. And the other thing too, I mean, it wasn't so much, again, it plays with the whole atmosphere thing, but the kids were just super immature. I mean, we would have the director of the program come and give a scolding to us because of the disrespect that the students would show the teachers. And it would just go to show you, like, these kids are just fresh out of high school and have no discipline and have no respect for their teachers or what we're being taught. And that also turned me off a lot, too, because I was there to learn and I was there to study and I was there to be serious, and I'd find myself sitting in class just daydreaming because of the rambunctiousness of some of the students, you know? And again, just they would really discriminate against anything organic, anything that's small scale. It's like, if you're not huge and you're not doing cash cropping or animal production or whatever, you're not a real farmer. You're just a city slicker, you know, who likes gardening, you know? But yeah, like I mentioned at the beginning, it was really when I, you know, after I had left the program, I traveled, I worked on several organic farms. I did a permaculture course. I visited some farms that blew my mind away, and they had nothing to do with conventional agriculture. And at the same time, part of my reason for leaving and going to travel, I went to go visit Maharashtra, India for 6 months. I lived there for 6 months, and there was over a 250,000 farmer suicides in India at that time because of conventional agriculture as the cause, you know? And I was like, well, my big question was, if I'm considering being a conventional farmer, why is this happening over there? Like, what's wrong, you know? And I wanted to go and see, and it was really sad what was happening over there. And it just proved to me that conventional agriculture was destroying the land, and it was not sustainable. And we're lucky over here, we have a temperate climate. We get a 6 month freeze where things just pause, and you don't have the same kind of ecology as you do in a temperate climate as you do in a tropical climate, where it's just a constant cycle that's much faster. And that leads to encountering the kinds of failures in the ecosystem that happen when you just dump chemicals in the ground all the time. And, you know, it leads to basically the end of farms, you know, like, and the land being destroyed. And so, you know, after I saw all that and I came back and I went back to the program and I tried it again and I tried to push my own ideas, I would do projects and I would say, like, for example, one of the big moments was like in beef and sheep production, and we would visit different beef and sheep producers, and then our project for the end of the season was to make recommendations to the farmer on what to do with his production to make it more profitable. And what I did was I converted one of the sheep farms to an organic production, and I said, you're going to be able to charge 30% more, you're going to be spending less on XYZ. I put a lot of effort into that project. I put more effort than students who got passing grades, and I got failed, you know. And I couldn't understand it, you know, like I couldn't reason with it, you know, and I lost all motivation after that. I lost all motivation. And I do have to like make a shout out to Caroline Begg though, because she was like the best teacher I had there. And she actually teaches an organic farming bachelor's. She teaches in that program. It's like a bachelor program. And like, she was always really supportive, and she still is. And she taught me a lot, and definitely like something I value the most about having gone to that program was meeting her and studying under her a little bit, and just having her support, you know, was really invaluable. So yeah, there's a lot of criticism, but also a lot of really, really, really beneficial stuff that came out of it.
And it seems to me that students over the years have tried to change it from the inside by starting things like the McDonald student
ecological garden.
Yeah. You know, and stuff like that. And I guess you witnessed that yourself when you were there to some degree.
Yes, I did actually. I think I was, when I started working for Stephen Homer the first year, I think that may have been one of the first years that MSEG was founded. And I worked then with Clémence Briand-Racine for several years. When she left that program, when she left MSEG, she went to Centre Paul, the Roulant. And so we worked side by side for several years. She's still one of my best friends. I actually was visiting her not long ago. And we're both like looking to buy our own farms. And so we're always bouncing things off each other. Land offers and land for sale and yeah, definitely you know, another person who I feel really connected with.
That's great. Well, so my last question, I guess, to finish the interview, what's your hopes, plans for this year, this growing season?
So because of the move this year, I decided not to increase my production whatsoever. I'm basically copying everything I did last year because the move has been really intense and it's just been like ongoing for the last month. And it's almost finished. But just to keep my life simple and less stressful, I'm just mocking my production from last year.
And if people are interested in getting your produce or finding out more or contacting you, what can they do?
They can send me an email at fermemtl@gmail.com or they can come to the St. Anne's Market every Saturday from 9 till 2. Or they can give me a shout at 438-989-8651.
Give me that number again.
438-989-8651.
Excellent. And do you have a website or a Facebook page? Or
I have both. You can find me on Facebook at FermMTL, or the website is FermMTL.com.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much for talking to me today.
No problem. It was my pleasure.
That was my interview with Konstantinos Hertl-Katou, the owner and farmer of Ferm de Lille. You can find out more about the market that he sells his produce at by going to marchesainte.ca. So that's Marché Saint, SAINTE, Anne.ca. And you can find out more about their market, which happens every Saturday from now until mid-October, from 9 to 2.
Vaccination against COVID-19 is now underway for priority groups. Visit quebec.ca/COVID-vaccine to follow the vaccination sequence planned for your area and book your appointment online. If necessary, you can also call 1-877-644-4545. Once you've been vaccinated, it's important to continue to protect yourself by following the basic health guidelines. The vaccine, a safe way to protect ourselves. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Recently, Democracy Now! Had a web exclusive. This interview actually played on Earth Day, but it was a very interesting interview with two Indigenous activists and scholars. One of them was Melanie Yazzie, who is the co-founder of the Red Nation, a grassroots Indigenous liberation organization. And the other person is Yohaikia Male, who is actually an indigenous person from Hawaii. And he is also a member of the Red Nation, a grassroots indigenous liberation organization. So these two people were interviewed on Democracy Now! Because they, along with two dozen indigenous scholars, came out with a new book called The Red Deal, Indigenous Action to Save Our Earth, which is described not simply as a response to the Green New Deal, nor a bargain with the elite and powerful. It is a deal with the humble people of the earth. So this was very interesting and I think timely. So we're going to feature that interview now from Democracy Now!
I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh, as we bring you our conversation with two indigenous scholars who've published a new book along with two dozen others titled The Red Deal, Indigenous Action to Save Our Earth. In Albuquerque, Melanie Yazzie is a co-founder of the Red Nation, a grassroots indigenous liberation group, chair of the board of directors for Red Media, an imprint of Common Notions. The Red Deal is Red Media's first publication. Professor Yazzie is a citizen of the Navajo Nation. She's Diné. She's an assistant professor of Native American Studies and American Studies at the University of New Mexico. Then we head north to Toronto. Waiakea Maoli is with us, a Kanaka Maoli scholar, activist from Manawili, Oahu. He's also a member of the Red Nation and assistant professor of Indigenous Politics at the University of Toronto. President Biden is holding a two-day global Earth Summit with some 40 world leaders. China is going to be a part of this conversation. You both, along with other scholars and activists, have proposed the Red Deal. Now, Senator Markey and Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez have proposed the Green New Deal. They have many co-sponsors. They've reintroduced it. Professor Yazzie, if you could start by responding to the Green New Deal, what you think works in it, and what the Red Deal adds as you talk about indigenous action to save our earth.
Sure. Thanks again for having us on the show. So we, you know, the Red Nation sat down in early 2019 to read the Green New Deal and to try to think about what is the role of indigenous people in the larger kind of vision for climate justice and addressing climate change that is given to us or proposed in the Green New Deal. So indigenous people are mentioned twice in the Green New Deal as it currently stands. We're mentioned in relationship to environmental racism, right? The disproportionate impact of things like resource extraction, pollution, climate disaster, those types of things. And we're also mentioned in relationship to treaties. And so something that we talk a lot about in the Red Deal that builds off of the Green New Deal, but perhaps expands it and creates a more comprehensive program that is not yet proposed or fleshed out in the Green New Deal is around treaties, right? We talk a lot about how treaties are between human beings. They're between nations, between indigenous nations and the United States. We know the history of treaty making in the United States is a history of broken promises, right? The U.S. acting absolutely like a predator nation, never upholding treaties, right? A huge part of the current land back movement, this kind of captivating indigenous decolonization movements at the moment, is about honoring and upholding and enforcing treaties, giving treaty lands back, right? Talking about the Black Hills or other kinds of places in North America. And so we talk a lot about how we need to enforce treaties as a sort of a baseline for kind of meeting indigenous people in terms of our struggle for climate justice and what we have to say about it. And so the Green New Deal does introduce that, or at least it centers it, I would say, in the way it talks about indigenous people. I would say, however, that when oftentimes the language around treaties, especially in the United States, people often talk about honoring treaties. And, you know, the Red Deal, we say we don't want to honor treaties. We want to enforce treaties, because if you're going to enforce treaties, you have to enforce indigenous laws that are based on being in right relation with the earth. And that needs to be a premise, right? That needs to be a premise for how we approach addressing climate change as a species. And so we're also talking about applying indigenous governance, traditions and customary governance, as well as sort of like what undergirds those treaties from an indigenous perspective at a much larger scale than what I think is often thought of or that the Green New Deal proposes, right? In order to curb the actual threat that climate change presents to us. It's presenting it to us on a level of a species, right? On a planetary level. So we believe that we can actually apply these indigenous principles to a global scale, that we can truly build mass movements, because we believe that mass movements and mass mobilization are what's going to be required, you know, to make sure that we're around in 29 years by the time the clock ends in 2050.
Professor Maile, in the introduction, you write, both of you write, you pose the question, in this era of catastrophic climate change, why is it easier for some to imagine the end of fossil fuel rather than the end of settler colonialism? You also, the book outlines a plan for collective climate action that can redress some of the problems that you outline. Could you explain what the principles are on which this collective climate action plan is based?
Yeah, certainly. And thanks again for having us on this expanded conversation. So the Red Deal focuses on four main principles, which are clear, comprehensive, like Dr. Yazzie explained, and also pragmatic. This is a radically pragmatic program about indigenous action to save our earth, which is not exclusive, but is inclusive. So the first principle of the Red Deal is that what creates crisis cannot solve it. So for instance, the greenwashing of the US military, which is one of the largest polluters in the world, I believe that the US military emits more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere than 100 countries globally. So introducing green technologies and the utilization of non-fossil fuel sources and fuel products for the US military is not going to change the ways in which US imperialism transits all over the world in destructive and cataclysmic ways. And so the idea that the US military being a massive polluter of not just the atmosphere, but obviously the entire earth, cannot be saved by simply greenwashing it, right? What creates the crisis cannot solve it. But this is also true for police protecting property and capital, not people. Even convictions of cop killers can't protect us, as we just recently saw during the trial of Derek Chauvin, who brutally murdered George Floyd. There was a bevy of other police killings. Dante Wright, Micaiah Bryant, these are two black people in the United States that were murdered by police during a trial for a cop killer that murdered George Floyd about a year ago. What creates the crisis cannot solve it. Prisons disproportionately contain and exploit black, indigenous, racialized, and poor people. Border Patrol and ICE don't keep us safe, but caged and controlled. And so we propose as a baseline fundamental principle in the Red Deal that what creates not just climate crisis, but violence cannot resolve it. The second principle is that change must happen from below and the left. You know, capitalism is destroying this planet. Some scholars like to throw around the term the Anthropocene to mark the period of time in which human anthropogenic activity has overwhelmed the earth and led to the current climate crisis that we're in. But other scholars refer to this as the Capitalocene, because this is essentially a period of time since the pre-industrial era in which the capitalist mode of production, which is also relative to the ways in which consumption occurs, has overwhelmed this planet. And so it is not just all human beings that are destroying this planet. It is a very small amount of human beings that are destroying this planet. And we in the Red Deal identify them as the capitalists, the bosses, the fossil fuel polluters, the military, the imperialists. So in order for change to happen, we see that it must occur from below and to the left. And thus we must destroy capitalism as a system of production, consumption, but also as an ideology. This means building people power, not power for corporations like a cap and trade system would enable, or a carbon tax and pricing system, which just bolsters the financialization of the climate justice movement But we see that this means building power for people, not corporations or nonprofits. The third principle is that politicians can't do what mass movements can. And my colleague and comrade, Dr. Yazzie, has already spoken to this, but in the book, we discuss how reform is a compromise. The Green New Deal is a compromise. We must no longer succumb to compromising on a dying planet. Non-reformist reform, which is what the Red Deal advocates for strongly, makes no compromises. So in the case of the Green New Deal, which its two primary mentions of indigenous peoples comes from, on one hand, marking indigenous peoples as passive objects of climate change and global warming that simply experience the disproportionate effects of climate change and global warming, like rising sea levels that are drastically affecting Pacific Island nations in Micronesia, in Hawaii, where I'm from. This is not the case. Peoples, indigenous peoples all over the world, are protecting their land, their resources, their more than human relatives. In Hawaii in 2019, there was a mass mobilization of Kanaka Maoli people to stop a techno-scientific project called the 30-meter telescope, which would be the 14th telescope observatory built on our sacred mountain Mauna Kea on Hawaii Island. Even as a techno-scientific project that purports to progress mankind and humans by searching for origins of our being in the universe and planets outside of our solar system, that project to hunt for Earth analogs and to find alien life outside of our solar system, to lay conquest outside of our solar system, depends upon the conquest and colonization of our Earth, of Hawaii, of Mauna Kea. And in 2019, a recent iteration of the opposition to the 30-meter telescope mobilized in mass, and we stopped this construction project, which is estimated at $2.4 billion, a multinational corporate project of which U.S. universities, the Canadian federal government, multiple governments have invested in. And the last is our principle from theory to action. Liberation isn't just a theory. It's a right. And it's a right for people to act. And people have already acted on the ground. And the Red Deal was born from that struggle. And it will continue to support that struggle on the ground.
I wanted to ask Professor Yazzie about the Standing Rock Sioux tribal historian LaDonna Brave Bull Allard, who just recently died of brain cancer at the age of 64. Now, she co-founded the Sacred Stone Camp on her own property along the Cannonball River in North Dakota in April of 2016 to resist the Dakota Access Pipeline. She said anyone who came to set up a teepee or a tent, she would give food to. She figured a couple dozen people would come. Soon, thousands came from around the world. Democracy Now! Traveled to Standing Rock Labor Day weekend of 2016 at the height of the protests. And we stood with LaDonna Brave Bull Allard at the Sacred Stone Camp just hours before the Dakota Access Pipeline Company unleashed dogs and pepper spray on Native water defenders seeking to protect a sacred tribal burial ground. This is what she said.
We say Miniwachoni, water of life. Every time we drink water, we say Miniwachoni, water of life. We cannot live without water. So I don't understand why America doesn't understand how important water is. So we have no choice. We have to stand. No matter what happens, we have to stand to save the water.
That was LaDonna Brave Bull Allard. She was really our introduction to the resistance to the Dakota Access Pipeline. Professor Yazzie, if you can talk about what you understand about why President Biden said he was reversing a number of President Trump's decisions, who green-lighted Keystone XL and Dakota Access Pipeline, one of his first acts in office. Immediately, when President Biden came into office, he nixed the Keystone XL pipeline, but hasn't done the same on DAPL, and what you think needs to happen there. And if you can also talk about what's happening with Oak Flat in Arizona.
Sure. So thank you for playing those beautiful words from LaDonna Brave Bull Allard. It broke my heart. I think it broke the heart of pretty much everyone across Indian country when we found out a couple of weeks ago that she had passed on in her journey into the next world. You know, something I've learned from the indigenous women who have really led the grassroots movements that we draw from in the Red Deal, the grassroots indigenous movements, right, is that the scale, again, I'm going to talk about scale, right? It's not climate. The earth tells us, and indigenous women who are caretakers, the primary caretakers of the earth, customarily in indigenous nations, remind us that this isn't something that's just about us as individuals. It's not even necessarily something that's just about us as indigenous people, but that the threat that we're facing is a species level threat, right? It's an extinction level event or an extinction level possibility. And so indigenous women always remind us, right, our primary responsibility as human beings in the here and the now is to caretake caretake the earth now to ensure future generations of life, to ensure life for the future generations of all people and all life on this planet. So it's very much a life-based movement, which is why water is life, right? Life being the operative word became such a rallying point and has continued to be a rallying point for indigenous grassroots movements around climate change. And LaDonna was really central to that. So my heart goes out to her family. In terms of Biden, you know, canceling KXL, but not DAPL. I mean, you know, Biden's his energy plan. I remember I was reading it back right before he was elected. And then his choice for Deb Haaland, right, as the Secretary of Interior, he talked a lot about preserving 30% of public lands by 2030, right, reducing carbon emissions. This is why he's having his climate summit, banning fracking, for example, on public lands, which I'm assuming Haaland is going to be carrying out as the DOI secretary. I think the fact that he didn't cancel DAPL has to do with the fact that the transition from so-called dirty energy, right, so coal, the things that we talk about in indigenous movements and view as resource extraction, we categorize as resource extraction, oil, uranium, gas, natural gas, coal. So that the transition from dirty energy to clean energy is one in which he still actually has to cater to the multinational corporations, right? The billionaires who have actually caused a huge part of the climate disaster in the first place, because those corporations, whether it's ExxonMobil, right, or Energy Transfer Partners, have already invested billions of dollars because they see the transition to green energy and green capitalism as the newest source of profit. And so they're already abandoning kind of the dirty energy production line and heavily investing in the clean energy revolution that I think we're going to be seeing over the next 4 years. And so Biden actually still has to work with those companies. You know, Biden was Obama's VP. Obama heavily subsidized the oil and gas industry, you know, at the beginning of his term as president, because he had to dig the United States out of the economic recession of 2008 and 2009. We're not necessarily in an economic recession right now, but the pandemic, right, has done crazy things, has really had an impact on the U.S. economy. And so I think you're going to have to see Biden pick and choose who he's working with in terms of energy corporations, because whether it's dirty or clean energy, it's still energy capitalism, right, is the name of the game in the United States. And the people and the nations that face the brunt of the destruction of energy development are almost always indigenous communities, often Black communities. And so I think that's part of the reason to explain that. So the Oklot struggle just continues. I remember, you know, the Red Nation came into existence in late 2014, right about 6 months before kind of the first flare up in the Save Oak Flat movement started in the summer of 2015, if people remember. So the struggle to save Oak Flat has actually been really central, I think, to the way indigenous people have been mobilizing on the ground and framing our struggles over the last decade, as has Standing Rock, as has Unist'ot'en Camp against Coastal GasLink pipeline up in so-called Canada, right? And so the Red Nation has really grown up alongside these types of movements and these uprisings like Oak Flat. You know, the recent decision about the environmental impact statement regarding Oak Flat has been encouraging, but nevertheless, you know, the copper, right? The resource that is being that Resolution Copper is trying to mine from that sacred land for the San Carlos Apache, you know, that's copper, and copper is considered a clean energy source. And so this is what I'm talking about when it comes to Biden's clean energy, the transition from dirty to clean energy. Copper is considered a clean energy source. Yet indigenous people are telling you very clearly that they do not consent to you mining. You know, copper from their sacred lands. So are you going to mine copper to subsidize and to, you know, invest in the green energy boom that you're proposing to address climate change and kind of to reduce carbon emissions? Or are you just going to yet again, you know, violate indigenous people and go and mine that copper anyway for this energy economy? And I think that, you know, this is what indigenous people force us to ask ourselves when we're talking about addressing climate change and when we're talking about reducing carbon emissions and global warming and addressing climate change. Are you going to keep violating our consent? Because we keep telling you no, and you keep doing it, right? And so these are some of the larger questions I think we need to consider when we're thinking about clean energy. And the Oak Flat struggle will continue, I think, to be a really important element of the indigenous kind of contribution and leadership in the climate justice movement to come.
Professor Miley, we'd like to end by going back to your book, The Red Deal, Indigenous Action to Save Our Earth. Could you talk about how this is a global fight as well, the alliances between indigenous populations and climate justice activists from native populations around the world and their commitment to both climate justice in the form also of decolonization?
Yes, certainly. So as we've talked already and my colleague, Dr. Yazzie, explained earlier, you know, indigenous people have been fighting environmental injustice since 1492. This is a centuries long struggle for us as indigenous peoples. But in 2018, when climate scientists agreed that emissions and warming would reach dangerous levels in 2030, giving us sort of 12 years left to do something, for us, the path forward was clear. It's decolonization or extinction. And land back is the soundest environmental policy. Indigenous peoples, despite making up 5% of the global population, protect 80% of the Earth's biodiversity. So climate policy should follow the leadership of those most affected, most experienced by and with climate change, not politicians in the command seat of governments causing it. And so what that means for coalitions and alliances between climate scientists, environmental activists, and indigenous peoples is that indigenous movements stand against extractive colonial projects, not just extractive projects, but identifying their colonial, settler colonial, and imperialist structure as extractive projects, while at the same time encouraging action for caretaking relations to protect the earth and all inhabitants of it, human and more than human. This means what we say in the Red Deal, which is that the Red Deal is a program for indigenous action to save our earth. And so this is an intervention into the kind of liberal environmentalist analysis and also activism that is currently taking place on the ground, which doesn't just exclude indigenous peoples and nations, but as my colleague Dr. Yazzie said, actually can contribute to settler colonialism and imperialism, not just in the global north, but in the global south as well, in Oceania and beyond. And so the Red Deal posits that the global north, in particular the US and Canada, isn't a leader in climate justice, but actually a leader in climate imperialism. And so the Red Deal makes clear that climate policy must be anti-imperialist. And this means ending sanctions against countries and peoples in the global south, ending the externalization of climate debt from the north to the rest of the world, right? If the global north has been the largest hemispheric polluter of the atmosphere and of the planet, then why is it that its debt gets externalized onto countries and peoples that have not committed the same kinds of cataclysmic emissions? This is what climate debt refers to. And we find this a very important coalition to align with countries and peoples from the global south that are experiencing very similar things that indigenous peoples are experiencing on a larger transnational scale. And so this is why the Red New Deal is not only unapologetically indigenous, but it's unapologetically anti-imperialist, because this is what it means to resist extinction and to work towards decolonization. Decolonization is not a passive project. It is not just decolonizing the mine. It's decolonizing the earth. It's land back for indigenous peoples. It's transforming nation states so that its governance system does not reflect imperialist neoliberal policies, but reflects the traditional ecological knowledge of indigenous peoples, where they are for who they are. And so this is what it means to decolonize, and this is what the Red Deal purports to actively provide a program that is not just revolutionary, but also pragmatic.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for joining us. Melanie Yazzie and Waikea Maile, new book, The Red Deal, Indigenous Action to Save Our Earth. They contributed to this book along with about two dozen other Indigenous scholars and activists. Professor Melanie Yazzie is a citizen of the Navajo Nation, assistant professor of Native American Studies and American Studies at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque. And Waikea Maile,
The following is a previously broadcast program.
At home, at a friend's place, and before entering a store, I wash my hands as soon as I can. I do it to protect the ones I love, my grandson, my husband, so I can continue to have people over this summer and enjoy weekends camping with my family. Because COVID-19 is still around, let's keep at it. Let's continue to properly protect ourselves. We're fighting the virus, so take a stand. Wash your hands.
All against one. All against COVID-19. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Just woke up in sunny Manchester. Yo, this is Roots Maneuver on CKUT on 90.3 Montreal. Check it out.
Travel near, travel far. It's sickly bizarre. Ain't a sound that plays so. Ain't a sound that stays so. Relevant to all soldier movement. Bringing improvement. Bashment and groovement. See the dub stack high. Quality supply. Tunes to dome.